Okay, so why don't we get started here? So I'm going to continue where we left off last time, and then I also have the exam to hand out today. Right, so recall that we were discussing distributed objects last time, and we left off here where I just started a case study on enterprise Java beans. Okay. So just to recap, we have already looked at objects before in the context of RMIs, and this was a more detailed look at various platforms that have distributed objects, provide these services, and so on. The basic idea here is interoperability across platforms. Okay, so both EJBs and CORBA that we are going to study have multiple implementations on different operating system, different hardware in different languages that can all interoperate because the specification and the interfaces are common. So this is what enterprise Java Bean looks like. Okay. So what's a bean? Basically, it's an object. It's a Java object that resides on a special type of server. Okay, so we already know something similar. So if you think of any Java object that resides on a JVM. Okay, so let's assume this is a Java virtual machine. This is your Java object. Okay, so if this is a remote object, then you can access it through RMI. Okay, so JVM supports the RMI interface, which allows some other JVM somewhere else to access methods on this object. This picture we already know. Okay, this is a similar picture. Okay, so this is your object. Okay, that's what's called an EJB or Enterprise Java Bean. There's a container for this object, and the server is basically does more than what a JVM does. It provides numerous services to access this object. So RMI is not the only method to or only technique to access this object. There are several others. Okay, so RMI is already supported. So this allows you to access methods using standard RMI, but there's also the JDBC interface. Okay, so JDBC stands for Java Database Connectivity. So this allows you to access these methods as well as these methods to access a database. Okay, using a Java interface. So you can write SQL queries in Java and trigger them through the JDBC interface, for example. So the JNDI, this is the Java naming interface. So this allows you to access objects with names and resolve them and so on. And then there is JMS, which is the Java messaging service. So this is like MQS, if you remember. It allows you to send abstract Java messages to other objects and so on. So you can use any of these methods for communication, not just RMIs. So that's something to keep in mind. Now, there are... So this is what is used by enterprise Java application. Okay, any server that actually supports EJB is referred to as a J2EE server. Okay, that stands for Java 2 Enterprise Edition. So there are many many implementations of these. So if you think about JBoss is an open source version of a J2EE server. IBM WebSphere is another example. BEA WebLogic. So these are all J2EE servers. And they tend to host these web applications that do pretty heavy duty processing. Okay, so you basically write your application as a EJB application. It runs on top of a J2EE server. It can have a web front end, but this is where all of the application logic resides. Okay, so you write it in this context. So the scenario is very no different, okay, although there is a lot more machinery here. Scenario is no different from the old case where we had a Java object, there was an interface and an implementation. The same thing is true here. There's an interface and there's an implementation. The interface allows you to create objects, delete objects, and so on. Okay. The one interesting thing here is EJB have this notion of a persistent object. Okay, the object state can persist across invocations of the server. We'll come back to that in a moment. Those are also referred to as entity beans. And there are classes that allow you to manage the object. This is the interface, and then the implementation, which is also referred to as a remote interface, is where you actually write the code for these objects. Okay, that's how what the object does, the methods on the object, or what is referred to as the business logic. Okay, this is nothing but the implementation of your application. Okay, that's the interface of your to your application. Okay. The terminology is slightly different. What we call client server now basically becomes a web application where there are users or other applications accessing services of the J2EE app. Okay, so there are four types of beans. Okay, so there's what's called a stateless, there are two types of session beans, a stateless and a stateful. And there's something called an entity bean and message driven bean. Together, they comprise what are called enterprise Java beans, the suite of various Java beans. So what do each of these do? Okay. So both the first two are transient objects. Okay. So these are objects that are created and destroyed depending on what the application is doing. Okay. As the name suggests, the stateless session bean is basically does not have any state. This is an object that is created on the fly. Okay. And it resides for what is referred to as a session. Okay, session may involve multiple requests. This could be a user session or in this case an application level session. So the lifetime of the object in this case is basically a session. And in this case the bean doesn't have any state. It just has some code that is executed whenever you call methods on it. Okay. The next one is stateful session bean. So here is where you would implement a shopping cart, for example. You could create a class. And the data in that class could hold whatever is in your shopping cart, for example. And the shopping cart is that this state is maintained so long as the user has a session. If this J2EE server is implementing a retail site, for example. Okay. And then the object is destroyed when the user is done with their transaction. Okay. If they have purchased the object or they just decide they don't want it, then the state of the cart is thrown or the object is deallocated. Okay. Now, entity beans are persistent beans. By persistent, what we mean is the state of this class does not go away even if you shut the server down. The state is actually stored on disk. Okay, so basically, the state persists across invocations of the server. And so this allows you to implement anything that requires persistent state, meaning it could be the catalog that you have could be implemented as an entity bean, for example. Because the state, and typically the state is maintained in an external database. Okay, it doesn't have to be maintained by itself, but you could use an external database to persist the state, or there could be other ways to persist the state. But regardless, the class actually has state that is going to be permanent. Okay, it doesn't go away. It's not stored in memory or doesn't go away. Okay? And message-driven beans are objects that are designed specifically for communication, okay, through messages or other forms. So that's why the name. So these are created whenever a message arrives, for example, to process the message, okay, and, or to make invoke or send a message to some other object. Okay, so these are the four types of beans that form the suite of EJBs. Okay, so there are many applications. Most of the web applications that you would see, any heavy duty application, is written as a J2EE app. Okay, and that basically there's Apache or some web front end to that, and this is the middle tier in our multi-tiered application. This becomes the middle tier as a database backend. Typically the EJB is accessing the database through the JDBC interface, and there's a web front end that allows you to make HTTP requests which are then handed to this middle tier. Yeah, that's how this fits into the big picture. Yes, question.
So EJB is a specification, right?
Yes, EJB is a specification. Yes.
And it can only run inside a J2EE compliant server.
Yes. So this is, yes, you're right. So it only runs inside a J2EE compliant server. That's because these are special types of objects. Okay, so you could, if you have a generic Java object, okay, it would run on a JVM, okay, arbitrary Java virtual machine. But EJBs have special interfaces which you can only access through a J2EE server. Okay, so this is think of it as a glorified Java virtual machine that gives you all of these interfaces or hooks to access these classes. If you run this class in a regular JVM and then you try to access it through some interface that's not supported, that doesn't work. Right? So this is like a JVM that has all these extra interfaces in there. Okay, does that make sense? Yes, question.
Different services, Do they have a different naming service for the same bean? I mean, how do I access the bean? Is that a common name?
Right. So if it's a the naming service is used for multiple things. One is to, of course, to name the objects themselves, but it is also named, you use the naming service to access the database or anything that requires a name, like tables, anything could be stored in there. So that's what the naming service is used for. Now, typically what happens is, although you could write another J2E server that calls this J2E server, in which case you would need to know what object names reside here and how to invoke them. Okay, but that is not typically the use of the naming server. This is for the application itself. So to persist names of database tables or other persistent objects, those would be stored in the naming service.
No, will it have the same name across the service? As an example, if you're using RMI, it has no URI. So,
right.
But the different services, will the same object have a single name or will it have a different name across services?
So there is no reason to keep it unique across across J2E server. It is unique within the instance of a J2E server. That's all. I mean, you could have the same name because you have a URI which includes the machine name, like a URL. So that object name is unique to that URL or that server, not across. Okay. So the next thing we are going to look at is CORBA. This is also a distributed object architecture. CORBA stands for Common Object Request Broker Architecture. This is what is often referred to as a middleware. Okay, we talked about middleware very early on. So here is an actual example of what a middleware layer looks like. Okay, so this is a software layer. Okay, this is the layer that allows objects to talk to one another. So it basically provides a number of services that makes it easy to write applications on top. Yeah, that's the basic idea. So CORBA is also a specification. Okay, the specification is was designed by this this group called the OMG or Object Management Group, and their basic goal was interoperability of distributed applications on various platforms. So long as you have a CORBA middleware running, and you can run an app on top, and then it can talk to any other CORBA. Okay, no different from JVMs. Okay, if you have a Java app, you can then run another Java app somewhere and they can communicate. The same thing is true here. And CORBA predated Java by more than a decade. Okay, so they started with these goals. You see some of them also present in later systems that have actually been designed. So I'll talk more about this picture. So at the core of CORBA is what is called an ORB or an Object Request Broker. Okay. This is the intermediary, or this is the heart of your middleware platform that allows anything in that runs on top to communicate with one another. Okay, so communication or mediation is the basic job of a broker. That's why it's called a broker. Okay, because it's mediating between two entities and allowing them to communicate. Okay, so it handles communication between objects and clients. It also handles distribution and heterogeneity. So it's the job of the ORB. So if this ORB is running on Solaris and you have another ORB on Linux or Windows, it's the job of the ORB to do the translation, all of the stuff we talked about in the context of RPCs and RMIs. All of that is done by the ORB. So the application, again, doesn't have to worry. Okay, so it just sends a message and the ORB decides when to send it and so on. Okay. It also allows you to compose services, and we'll talk about services in just a moment. So there are many, many types of services that that CORBA supports. There are some that are called common object services. We'll talk about them. There are some that are vertical, meaning that they are domain specific. If you're using CORBA in a particular domain, like say financial domain, there would be financial services that somebody would have written that you can tap into. And there are horizontal services that are common, like naming, for example. This is independent of whether this is a healthcare application or a financial application or a manufacturing. You may need naming in all of them. So these are horizontal services. They are general purpose. These are domain specific. And then there are some lower level services called common object services. Okay. So this is the object model. And all of these object models are very similar to one another. If you actually look at the heart of it, there is what is called a stub or a skeleton here. Basically, that job is done by the ORB. Okay, so that's the ORB here. So there's a client ORB and a server ORB, and that's the middleware the application is basically written on top. And what here you can, Korba supports two types of invocations, static invocations and dynamic invocation. The static invocation is what you already know. You write the code in using the interface definition language, and the type of the object, etc., is known at compile time itself. Okay? Korba also supports what's called a dynamic invocation, where the application can decide at runtime what type of object it even wants to call. Okay, this may not be specified at compile time. So you just declare a generic object reference or an object pointer, and you populate it at runtime. Okay? So at runtime, the ORB has to figure out what type of an object it is, where the server is, import the interface, because the interface is not known at compile time. So there's no header files to include that tell you these are the methods, for example. None of that is known because you don't even know what object is being called, okay, at compile time. So that is one interesting difference between Korba and some of the other systems. Okay, most of the other system use what is called static invocation, which means when you write the code and you compile it, it is known what type of object it is and so on. Okay? Here, this may not be known, and Korba actually supports this dynamic invocation. And this is done by what a generic invoke operation. Okay, this takes an object reference or a pointer as an input, and then does the rest. It figures out what type of object it is, where the interface resides, and imports the interface at runtime. Okay? And there's an interface repository. Okay, that stores all the interface definitions. Okay, there's a repository that is, where is it shown? It's not shown in this picture, but there is a repository where all of these, whenever an object starts up, it exports its interface, is stored in something called a repository, which is effectively a database. Yes?
Can you show us an example of a dynamic invocation?
An example of why it is needed?
How to use it.
Just one second. So we'll come to some code later on. So basically, if you don't know what you want to invoke, what objects you want to invoke at compile time, okay, so that's the use of it. How to invoke it, I'll show you some code, maybe that will make it a little more clear later on. Okay, so that's what a core object looks like. And here are some services. Okay, so there are actually many more that I'll show on the next slide, but here are just a few that just give you a feel for what you can do. Okay, collection service allows you to create lists, queues, stacks. So this is basically a list of services that allow you to organize your data into various data structures. Okay, you don't have to declare it. You can just use or write your own. You just use that service. Okay. Query service provides you query languages to query a service. The context of EJB, the instantiation of this is JDBC. That allows you an interface to write SQL queries to a database, but you could use queries for arbitrary purposes. The query service supports various query languages. Okay. Concurrency service provides you threading capability, locking capabilities, and so on. Okay. If you want to write multi-threaded apps, you just use the functionality provided by the concurrency control service. Okay. And it will do things automatically for you. It will create a thread whenever a request comes, for example. Okay, you don't even have to tell it that I want to create a thread. If you just specify a request per a thread per request model, whenever a new request comes into your object, it will start a new thread. Okay? Now, locking you have to do. It's not going to do that for you. But it will provide you functionality to do the locking. Okay? Event service we'll look at in more detail shortly. This allows you to implement what are called publish subscribe services. Okay, so where producers of data and consumers of data can be brought together using this thing called an event service or an event channel. Okay, and there are several more as is shown in this picture or in this table. Okay, there's one more I want to point out. Here is a transactional service. So if you want to write transactions in your application, you just use the transaction service and just starts a begin transaction, end transaction, and it ensures that anything in between becomes an atomic operation. Okay, all the stuff that we talked about earlier. And there are many more. There's a persistence service. This allows you to store object state on disk and then recover it later. Okay. So all of this is already there. So this makes your job of writing applications, distributed applications, very simple. Because they have looked at all the various building blocks that are part of most distributed applications and then abstracted them as services so that you just use to write your application. Okay. So there are many object invocation models that are implemented. The synchronous one is what you already know. This is the default RMI RPC model where you make a request, okay, or invoke an RPC or an RMI and block, okay, until the response is received. So that is already supported. You also have one-way and deferred synchronous method invocation. So this should ring a bell because we talked about this in the context of RPCs. Okay, there are various RPC models that we studied. So object invocations in Korba also support multiple semantics, okay, not just synchronous. Okay, one way is just best effort delivery. Just make a invoke a method and you continue. Okay, and then the ORB is going to send that method over using a message to the server and so on. Okay. Deferred synchronous basically is asynchronous where caller is going to continue and at a later point as a callback is going to happen telling you that the response has been received. Okay, this is a way to implement asynchronous method invocations. Now, all that said, it's a powerful platform that's been around for nearly two decades, but hasn't caught on a whole lot. Okay, unlike J2EE, which is widely used, okay, any web application that is deployed out there in industry uses J2EE or some variant thereof. Okay, Korba hasn't really caught on. Some of the ideas in Korba have appeared in EJBs, as we just saw. It's a much simpler implementation of these ideas. Okay, there are a few applications today that use it, but not a whole lot. So Linux's GNOME desktop actually uses Korba. Okay, not full-fledged Korba, but a very simplified version of Korba. It has an ORB that it uses to communicate across the networked applications and so on. Okay, but not a whole lot. Okay, there are some embedded variants of Korba, but not much. And the problem why this did not take off is this was a usual standardization problem where there's endless discussions on how to come up with a standard and an interface. Okay, and then you expect that once you standardize, somebody is going to use it. Okay? And sometimes it does happen that way and sometimes it doesn't. Okay, so in this case, it didn't happen. That they spent a lot of time, wasted a lot of trees and nobody used it. So the reverse is usually better where you basically have a bottoms-up approach where some people start using something and then you say, okay, this is becoming popular. Let's standardize it so the usage can grow and interoperability will not be hurt in the process. Okay, so in this case, it went in the other direction and never really took off. But nevertheless, it's an interesting technical study for us because it has a lot of features that were then later on used in one way or another. The same thing happened, if you remember, in X.500. That was a directory service that nobody used, but some simpler variants of it like LDAP are still used widely. Okay, so that's the same story here. So now let's look at the event notification service. And the reason I pulled it out of Korba is because it is something more general and is used by other systems also. So this is what is also referred to as a publish-subscribe paradigm for communication. Okay. So what happens here is there is an intermediary, which we'll call an event channel. This is basically a buffer. Okay? And these are the producers of the data. They produce data that are stored in a buffer. Okay? And these are the consumers of the data, and this data is delivered to the consumers. Okay? So this is just a way to connect producers and consumers of the data. Okay? And here the data is generated as an event. Okay? The abstraction is an event. Event is could be anything, and you could just produce a record and say this is an event and stick it there. So what data is contained in an event is immaterial. Okay, it's just a way to generate some data, and event is a way to deliver that data to the consumer. So there are many models. Okay, there's a push model and there's a pull model. So what this picture shows is a push model where producers are generating data and they store it into this buffer. Okay. And then so this is the middleware. Actually. So this is not just a passive buffer that's sitting somewhere in memory. There is an entity here that is actually looking at what events are arriving, and then in this case they are being pushed out, okay, to the consumer. Now some variant of this, you probably remember the exam question where I asked message queuing service and your project. as I said, connect your the middle tier to the database using MQS, which is a persistent queue or a buffer. That's basically a publish subscribe paradigm that you use to connect your middle tier of the application to the backend. Okay, rather than making a query, you just put a request in the middle tier into the MQS, and then the MQS delivers it. The same thing is true here. MQS also enables publish subscribe. Okay, just to keep that in mind. So this is push, and here is pull. So what happens in pull is consumers are pulling the event channel, saying, do you have any data for me? Okay. And the event channel in turn keeps pulling the supplier, saying, do you have any events I've generated? And you pull the events from the supplier into the buffer here, and the consumers pull events from the buffer into their applications. Okay. Now, this is a very generic model. So if you actually look at the event service in more detail, you'll see the reason it is called publish and subscribe is that consumers can subscribe to certain types of events. It's not as if all the data that's stuck into this buffer is delivered to all of the consumers. You can produce different types of data, okay, different types of events, saying this is an alert event versus this is some data I have generated. And consumers can also subscribe to different types of events. You can say, deliver all alerts to me, but I don't care about data, only alerts. Okay, so only those types of events would be delivered. Okay, so you subscribe to certain types of events. Okay, that's why it's called a channel, because it has various channels of events. Okay, and you can subscribe to whatever you want. So it runs filtering to make sure all of the data that's coming in, which of that data should be delivered to each of these consumers. Because each consumer may have a different interest set in the event. Okay. So if you look at the publish subscribe paradigm in a lot of detail, you'll see that you have to implement filtering inside that event channel. You have to implement a way to subscribe to different types of events and publish different types of events. So there are multiple queues here, one for each event type. Okay? There's a list of subscribers, and whenever an event arrives, then you decide, look at all the subscribers that match that event type and only deliver it to that subset. Yeah, so you have to do things like this in the context of publish subscribe. Now this service is also supported in Corba, but as I mentioned, the idea is general and it has really taken on, and other systems have also implemented similar services. Yeah, so nobody in the context of Corba uses it, but if you use MQS or other systems like that, they are used widely. Even in J2E, you have publish subscribe as a way to manage events. Any questions? Is this clear? Okay. So here is a picture that shows this various method invocations that I was talking about. So here, this is the asynchronous method. Okay. So the typical RMI scenario is synchronous, where the client invokes a remote method and it would block, okay, wait for a response. So how does Corba implement this asynchronous method? So this is a good picture to show this. So there's a call by the application that goes to your stub or the proxy, and then it goes to the ORM, and ORM sends it out to the server, and the client application continues. Okay, so client is not blocked at this point. The client is continuing. So at some later point in time, a response has arrived from the server. Okay, this is the response to your method, and this has to be delivered back to the application. And the way this is done is through what is called a callback. So callback is basically, it's like an interrupt that gets generated. Okay, so you register the callback with the callback interface and say, whenever you get a response, notify me. Okay, so the callback is going to notify the application saying your response has arrived. Okay, at that point, the application basically has to do what you do when you get an interrupt. Stop doing what you are doing and then go into the callback routine and process the response. Okay, once you're done, then you can continue what you are doing. So you get interrupted at some later point in time, and then you process the response. Okay? And so you have to implement this callback interface to do this. And the client has to register callback functions, which are called by the interface whenever responses arrive. Okay? Is this clear? So here is a different way to implement the same asynchronous method. Okay? This uses polling. So there are no callbacks in this case, but the client has to pull. So you make a request, you call a method, and again the ORM sends it off to the server. Okay? And the client is going to continue. So some at some later point, a response is going to arrive, and it is going to sit here at the polling interface. Okay, in the meantime, it's the client's job to take delivery. Okay? In the previous case, it was the middleware job to deliver the response through the callback. So when the response arrived, the middleware has to call a function to notify the application and deliver it. Okay, in this case, it's the application's responsibility to decide or to determine if a response has arrived and take delivery. The middleware is not going to do anything. It will just queue up the response in this interface, and the client has to periodically poll saying, did a response arrive? Okay, and so on. If you know about interrupts, these are the two ways to also do interrupt processing. In some cases, you do a busy wait and you poll. In other cases, you continue and there's an asynchronous signal that's raised that causes you to jump into an interrupt service routine. The same ideas hold even here. Okay, so the client is polling, and this is a non-blocking poll. Just say, has a response arrived? You get a yes or no answer, and then if it's no, then you continue doing something else and then poll a little later. And at some point, a response is going to arrive, at which point you have to take delivery of that response and then process it. Okay. So same idea implemented in a different way, okay, using a polling technique or a callback technique. Is this clear? Okay. So now let me talk a little bit about this notion of a portable object adapter. So one nice thing about CORBA is they allow you to take an arbitrary non-CORBA application and make it look like a CORBA application. Okay, and this is done through what are called wrappers. So let's suppose you have a C application. Okay, this is not even an object-oriented application. This is just a piece of code that you've written. Okay, now you want to make it available as a CORBA application to other CORBA applications. Okay, now typically the way you would have to do it is you have to rewrite the whole thing using an object-oriented framework, add methods, and so on and so forth. Okay, but that is a lot of work. So the way they, the one technique that they developed that simplifies the task of making an application look like a CORBA application is what's called a portable object adapter. So in this case, what happens is you have what are called what look like logical objects. They're not real objects. They're logical objects that are basically maintained in a table. So these are not real objects, and these basically are pointers to blobs of code in your actual application, which are referred to as servants. Okay? So you export an interface, and whenever that a method on that interface is called, this is a wrapper that actually calls the real functions in your C application. So you have, let's say you have some functions in your C application. So then what you would do is you would write just an object interface, and maybe these functions would become methods themselves, or there are some other methods, let's say foo prime, that basically involves code that will call some functions in your application. Okay, so this is basically just a table into where your what your code is doing. And whenever these methods are invoked, these are wrappers that actually call methods in your non-CORBA application. Okay, so this allows you to layer a CORBA interface on arbitrary code and basically make it look like a CORBA application. So Java does something similar. You can wrap, invoke C methods or C functions using Java methods, if you know. So the same thing is true here. So you'll see that these ideas have lived on, although this system is not really used. Okay, so this is the way you do it. So there is this active object map that points to servants, and all this second figure is showing is multiple objects can just point to one blob of code. This is one application, and you have created multiple objects. Okay, this is object-oriented interface. Or you could have arbitrary blobs of code. These could be independent applications. They all expose this CORBA interface. So you could write these wrappers and do this. Okay, so here is some code that allows you to do some stuff. So this is your C++ object. So here you are adding a CORBA interface on some C++ code. So this is your C++ object. And you declare a CORBA object as well. This is an identifier, not an object. CORBA object identifier. And you assign, create basically a new C++ object, and then you activate it. Okay, this registers the C++ object as a CORBA object. Okay, just as an example. Is this clear? So this has changed your C++ app into a CORBA app. Any questions here? Okay.
You mean you can call some active objects functions to let it around the C++ objects to the
right. Framework? Yes. Basically, that's what has happened. You have a C++ application. You write this wrapper code that takes your object and registers it with Korba. And then Korba allows you to use all of the standard Korba interfaces to access methods in your C++ application. Okay, and then you can do all this also with C. It doesn't even have to be object-oriented. In this case, it is object one object-oriented framework exposing another object-oriented framework interface. But you could just, a servant could be written in C, doesn't matter. Okay, the wrappers, well, you could still write wrappers for it. Any other questions? So now we are going to talk a little bit about replication in the context of distributed object. Right? Replication is for two reasons. Okay, we always talked about replication for either fault tolerance or high availability. Which means if the machine running one object or one server service goes down, you can still access the service. Okay. And you could also do this for performance reasons. So Korba again supports this as a service. Okay, there's a replication service that is used. So whenever an object calls another method, you first decide if that method or rather that other object is replicated or not. And if it is replicated, you access it through the replication service. And what that does at the underneath is it uses reliable multicasting. Okay? So instead of sending your RMI request to just one instance of an object, it multicasts that request to all instances of the object. Okay? So any one of them or all of them can respond. If multiple responses are received, it is going to coalesce them and send back one response. Okay. So this is what is done in the context of Korba. And then there is also logging and recovery. If there is failures, you can figure out which responses have been received, so you create a log. So all of this machinery is built into it. So as you can see, it is a fairly heavy-duty middleware, as it has lots of functionality. So now let me talk about replication in the object-oriented world in more general. So the basic problem that we want to look at is as follows. So here let's say there's an object foo, and there are methods, state here and so on. Then there is another object. We'll assume that this object is replicated. Okay, so we'll say same object is replicated in this case 3 times. Okay. So if you want to call some method, let's say some function here. The question is, what should the stub here do? Yeah, because there are 3 instances of it. So first you have to, whenever this function on this replicated object is called, you have to first intercept this at some level. Okay? And then you have to decide what to do. Okay? So what this slide is showing is where would you intercept it. So you can intercept it at the client side before the invocation goes to the stub, which means you basically intercept it here. Okay, and then decide to do something. Or you do this inside the stub, okay, which is you basically intercept it inside the stub, or you do it at the server side, okay, which means you would do it here. Okay, and the problem is one where you have to figure out if you are going to use this for fault tolerance, that any method that you call here on these objects has to be sent to all 3 replicas. Okay, so for this, you need to understand, this stub needs to know that there is replication going on. If the stub knows that there's replication going on, then you could decide at the client side that intercept any accesses to those functions and then multicast them to this object. If you don't know that that object is replicated, then you would basically send it to one of these replicas, and then that replica has to then forward that to the other two. Okay, so you could either do it at the client end or you do it at the server end. Okay, so there are these 2 possibilities. Either at the client end before you enter the stub, inside the stub, Okay, or so if you do it inside the stub, then the stub has to be replication aware and it has to implement some replication algorithm. Okay. If you do it above the stub, then you can actually layer a replication framework on a standard stub. Okay, then you don't really need replication support in the stub itself. You basically intercept it here and call the stub 3 times with the different replicas, and it would just send these 3 methods out. Okay, so these are the various techniques that you could use to implement replication. So this is basically what EJB does. Right? So here you have, this is the client, that's the server. Okay, in this case, the server is an enterprise Java bean, and the object resides in this EJB container. Okay, so basically replication is done at this level. Okay, so the client basically knows about replicas, and then it invokes the same method on multiple replicas. Okay? And then these methods arrive here, and then you basically just execute the methods and send back responses. Okay? And then the responses have to be merged. Okay? Now there are interesting problems arise if this object itself makes additional requests on other objects. Okay? In this case, there's a client and there's the server is implemented as a single object. But that need not be the case. The server may comprise of multiple objects. Okay? Some objects may be replicated, others may not be replicated. So this creates interesting problems like this, as is shown in this picture. So let's suppose that the client is A. Okay? The server has two objects, B and C, but B is replicated, okay? But C is not. So when you invoke the first method, this is sent to all 3 replicas. Okay? Each of them execute the exact same method. Okay? And it is assumed that to answer that method, you have to invoke a third object C. Okay? C could be a database, for example. Okay? But it could be some any arbitrary object. So if you do this, you are going to make 3 requests to C. Okay? And if C is not idempotent, this is going to cause problems. Right? So suppose this is a shopping application where you have just sent off a buy request. Okay, so you want to buy what is in your shopping cart. Your middle tier is replicated here. So this buy request is actually processed by all 3 replicas. Okay, and they may generate an order. And they may ask C to do something with the order. So if you send 3 orders to C, that's going to be a problem. Right? You cannot do this 3 times because that's not idempotent. So this is something you have to keep in mind when you have replication, that there is, it's okay to have one client sending requests to 3 multiple replicas. But if those replicas access other methods and those methods are not replication aware, then you are trouble. If this could be made replication aware, in which case it would first merge these requests and only process them once. Okay? But that requires logic in this object to be made replication aware. Either you have to put that in the stub or you have to put that in the application code. If it's not replication error, if it's just a standard object that you've written with some methods in it, then you are going to get into problems if you don't pay attention to this issue. So here is one possible solution. So the solution here is one where you have a coordinator. So these are, in the previous picture, we assumed that all 3 replicas were identical. So here the replicas have to replicated objects have to elect a coordinator, and it's that coordinator's job to funnel all requests to any other objects. Okay, so in this case, this A is going to make 3 requests. Okay, this identical copies of 3 requests to B1, B2, and B3. They will all process this, and then they'll generate a response which is sent to B1, which is the coordinator for B. Okay, then if B1 needs, or if they want to make a request to C, then B1 will only send one copy of the request. In this case, C is also replicated, so actually there are 2 that are sent. But you don't send, B2 and B3 don't send anything. Yeah, everything goes through the coordinator. Okay, yes?
Isn't this having the very purpose of replication?
Right. The question is, does this not defeat the very purpose of replication? If B1 goes down, then what do you do? That's the question, right?
No, the going on one aspect, but the other thing is like load balancing is not being achieved over here.
Right. So we are talking about fault tolerance here, not performance, right? If it was performance, then you wouldn't have sent the thing to all three, would have sent only one and tried to load balance. So this is replication for high availability, meaning that if any of them fail, the service as a whole continues to function. Okay, so that problem we'll not worry about. But at the same time, the issue of what happens if B1 fails is still valid. Any ideas on what you do? What would you do if the coordinator fails? You have to elect a new one. So you would have to implement leader election and all of that stuff that we have studied in the previous chapter here as well. Yeah, because any time your coordinator, that's a single point of failure. That will defeat the whole purpose of replication if you cannot dynamically choose your coordinate. Okay, so you do have to do that. Okay. Now the coordinator doesn't only coordinate the sending of requests, it has to coordinate the sending of responses as well, or returning the responses. So in this case, there is a coordinator at C. It will produce responses that will go through the coordinator, and then the coordinator will send it to the other two. Okay, so that's what is shown in this picture. So although this arrow shows that the result has come directly, it actually goes through the coordinator, and the coordinator says send it to these other two replicas as well. Okay, it's coordinating two things. It's sending the request and coordinating the responses back as well. Okay. Any questions on this? Okay, so I'm going to stop here for today. I'll hand out the exams. And then the only thing that we have left is one last chapter on DCOM and Genie, okay, which we will do on Tuesday. And then the remaining classes will be advanced topics like sensor networks and mobile computing that go beyond the textbook. Okay, but we still have to look at a few of these advanced topics. Okay, so let's stop here. Let me hand out the exam.